Hey there, I am John Cryer, and this is the Undisclosed Addendum. So, the Undisclosed team has been incredibly busy the past couple of weeks putting out a triptych of episodes on the Dennis Perry case and Camden County criminal justice dysfunction, as well as a special episode about the state of Maryland's appeal hearing in the Adnan Syed case, and we are going to talk about all of them. And with us today is Colin Miller. He's an associate dean and professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he blogs at Evidence Prof Blog. How you doing, Colin?
I'm great, John. How about yourself?
I'm still great. I was great last 3 weeks ago or 2 weeks ago, and I'm still great. Why are you questioning that? It's the big question.
Well, I don't know if you go sort of like method with Lex Luthor. You know, you need to sort of get into role and get into a dark state there. I don't know.
Yeah, no, yes. For those of you who did not read the internet kerfuffle of a couple weeks ago, I will be playing Lex Luthor on Supergirl. Thank you for the plug, by the way, Colin. Much appreciated. Yeah, I'm going to be starting that in Vancouver next month, which I'm excited about, mostly because I grew up being a huge fan of the Superman movies, obviously with Gene Hackman. And I was actually in one of them playing Lenny Luthor, his evil nephew, who's incredibly dim.
I've seen the YouTube clips.
Yes, exactly. And I think we all need to move on from that. I think that
memory hole.
That's best for everybody. As I'm sure you listeners know by now, that we are joined by Susan Simpson here. She's an associate of the Volkov Law Group and also the host of the 45th. Hey there, Susan.
Hey, John. And just so you know, the reference to Lex Luthor and I think one of the episodes was written before I found out the news.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Yeah, I didn't think it was a necessarily a shout out.
I was not calling you Guy Barentine for the record.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. I'm often confused with him. Thank you guys for putting out the special episode about the Court of Appeals hearing, because obviously many of our listeners are very into that now. And you did it on incredibly short notice. I had just a couple of thoughts, not so much questions. Robbie told that wonderful story of the moment of awkwardness in the elevator with Thiru Vignaraja, who is back again as the pro bono prosecutor. How long is this guy going to work for free? Is my question.
Till the case is over, I'm sure.
Okay, that's just, again, I have mentioned this on past episodes. My understanding is he's obviously a talented attorney, not unintelligent, and obviously dedicated to seeing this case through for some reason. But I had a question. He has often misstated evidence in the past, and that to me I've ended up attributing malign intentions on his part, which is, you know, I don't know if that's fair. Because he's a public servant.
He's not.
Oh, you're right.
Job.
Now that you mention it, he's not anymore. He clearly is smart enough to know better. Did he once again state that Adnan's alibi, for what it's worth, was not corroborated by Asia McClain's testimony? Because he's misstated that several times in the past where he's claimed that it contradicted it. Did he do that again?
He kind of hits all the points, like usual. I mean, he's got the whole, like, public school library, school library mix-up going on.
Exactly. See, that to me is what, you know, again, he was a public employee. He was doing his job. I don't wish to attribute malevolent intent to that. But when he knows better, he knows that Adnan's account in no way contradicts what Asia said. For him to keep using that, to me, says, okay, he stepped over a line.
Well, it's clearly personal. I mean, that's the big red flag here. This is clearly a personal issue for him. He has no obligation to keep doing this. Most attorneys don't keep doing cases and they stop being prosecutors. He's doing this because it's a personal issue for him. It's political as well. He's staked his career on it. And when you have a prosecutor pursuing a case for such nakedly non-part of his job reasons, that's a problem. So this is not an okay situation in general for me.
The only thing that is gratifying, of course, about Thiru participating in this is he is occasionally incompetent. Again, the state's arguments always seem to the, you know, and I didn't actually listen to the live stream, but in reading accounts of it, the problems with it seem apparent. It seems like, remember when the first appeal briefs were lodged, they seemed sort of badly worded and not particularly well thought out. It seems like if you're going to do it pro bono, you might as well do a good job.
I'm not sure if he's actually doing the briefing. He doesn't always do it. I don't know for sure. I mean, it might not be his freeze. I don't think we know exactly who wrote them.
Mm-hmm. I also had this as sort of a side question, because one of the things that the Undisclosed series did so well was exposing the, you know, incredible health problems that Christina Gutierrez was going through at the time, and the way that it was affecting her practice in so many other cases. Is there ever going to be a situation where that can be, because you hear these things and you just go, you know, she was making these huge errors or disastrous strategic choices under the influence of, you know, a terrible illness that was causing her behavior to change over, you know, with several of her clients at this time. And is that just never going to be information that could? No, really?
Nope. They don't care. The judge kept it out of the hearing. There was no evidence of it. So it's not part of this. The fact that she was actually falling apart is not part of the case.
There is one possibility, though, and this was pointed out by Steve Klepper, who wrote an amicus brief in this case, and that is there was actually another case, the Merzbacher case, which was an ineffective assistance of counsel claim against Gutierrez. And in that case, the state actually asked the judges to take what's known as judicial notice of her issues and her downfall in her later years. Judicial notice is, even if it's not in the record in the case, if it is well known in the community, it's not subject to reasonable dispute, judges could take notice. And so I think it's very unlikely, but it's possible you could see a judge in an opinion from this court saying, we take judicial notice of the fact that she was in this declining condition at the time she represented a nun.
And interestingly, the state did stipulate to new information on this one in terms of the
non-contact, that no one from the defense team had contacted Asia before trial.
Yeah. And that's an interesting, you know, it's why are they choosing now to stipulate that? Does it help their argument in some way?
I think it's just, you know, jettisoning a lost cause argument is what it is.
Yeah, there was basically no chance that this court was going to reverse that factual finding. And so I think they sort of just sort of chalked that up as a loss and decided, let's go ahead and argue from there, as opposed to trying to relitigate that and waste time during oral arguments.
And the lack of discussion about the cell tower issue, do you attribute that to they've just made up their minds and didn't have any questions about it?
Or it could just be they didn't have questions that would make for good oral arguments questions. I mean, it's hard to predict that.
Yeah, and that's a good point by Susan, because, I mean, this all comes down to how you interpret this case that was decided by the Court of Appeals in Maryland. And there's just not a whole lot of precedent or argument there, I think. Obviously, Judge Welch ruled one way, the Court of Special Appeals ruled the other way, and to Susan's point, it might be just that they think there's nothing that the attorneys could say during oral arguments that would really move the needle much.
Yeah, they either believe one way or the other. They either agree with the first court or the second. Would that be the case?
Yeah, and that's true, and it's, you know, a lot of what happens at oral arguments, when you hear them in this case, the Court of Special Appeals and Court of Appeals, it's a lot of sort of hypotheticals by the judges. Well, what if this fact were true? Is this a per se rule? And the cell tower issue, at this point at least, is really just about waiver. It's not about, does an incoming call establish the location for liability purposes at a trial? It is, did a non knowingly and intelligently waive his ability to make this claim? And there's just not a lot of room there to sort of pose interesting questions during oral argument on that issue.
It's not about the cell phone at all. It could be any item here. It's just a cell phone has to be what it is now, but the fact that cell phone evidence is irrelevant to the legal argument for the court at this moment.
Got it.
I would like to apologize. My cat's scratching is coming through. I don't know if y'all can hear that.
We cannot.
Okay, good.
We cannot. We do, however, have a visual image that we are grateful for at this moment of your cat.
Frantically,
frantically scratching at the chair that you're sitting
on? At
the
door.
Okay, fair enough.
All right, I have a confession. I have not always known how to adult. And by that, I mean I've never, ever, ever, until I got the Robinhood app, invested in anything. I don't know how to invest. This is the big problem for me. And I'm well into my 40s. But Robinhood is an investing app that has changed all of that, because it lets you buy and sell stocks, options, cryptos, everything commission-free. And it's so intuitive. The app is just so easy. It's clean. I am learning as I'm going. You don't have to be a savvy investor. And also, you don't have to be wealthy to use Robinhood. Robinhood is an app that's designed for everybody. You don't need to be able to throw tons of money at the stock market. You can invest small amounts, you know, whatever you're comfortable with. It's a totally non-intimidating way for stock market newcomers like me to invest for the first time with some true confidence. And as you get better at it, you might want to throw some more money into it. But for now, start off small. Check it out. Learn. It's simple, intuitive, like I said before. Now, once again, there's no cost, no commission fees, and other brokerages do charge up to 10 bucks for every trade. Robinhood does not charge commission fees at all. You keep all of your profits, every dollar, all right? It's, again, easy to use. They have great charts and market data. I get little notifications from Robinhood saying, oh, this stock is up, this stock is down, and stock-related news. And you can place a trade with just four taps on your smartphone. They also have these really cool collections, like the 100 most popular stocks, like sectors like entertainment. You can even look at categories that are curated, like female CEOs, right? And analyst ratings of buy, hold, sell for every stock. There's just so much information there. You learn so much, and it's just so easy to use. And I've just really enjoyed finally adulting on this issue. So look, Robinhood is giving our listeners a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint. These are big companies to help build your portfolio. All you got to do is sign up at addendum.robinhood.com. Once again, that's addendum.robinhood.com to get your free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint. So check it out today.
Okay, well then, let's segue to the Camden County episodes, which were fantastic, by the way. A lot of, you know, every time I thought, okay, there's something, you know, that's a big thing to drop, it would be followed by another one. that first episode was, it's called Being a Judge, and we met some of the jurors in that instance, and also talked about Judge Amanda Williams and her sort of troubling history. I was curious. Okay, the thing that jumped out at me was her idea of giving indefinite sentences. Between that and sending prisoners straight to isolation, which would deny them contact to the outside world, doesn't that start to raise constitutional issues? I mean, that gets close to cruel and unusual punishment to me.
It does. I mean, it gets into a lot of issues, but the one that mattered for her purposes was whether it violated judicial codes of conduct. And it did. Well, it never actually got resolved that way because she resigned before it could be resolved. But yeah, there are a lot of troubling issues brought up by what she was doing.
And is there any kind of redress for that? I mean, there's obviously the judicial, as you said, code of conduct. But can a private citizen sue in that situation?
I am sure you can always sue.
I know, this is America. I forgot, you know.
I don't think so, no. I mean, the issue was really not the individual cases. It was her fitness for being a judge still was what the legal proceedings were about.
Yeah, and generally there's the concept of what's known as judicial immunity that says a judge is essentially immune from any actions that they performed as a judge in their judicial capacity. So that would pretty much immunize her from any lawsuit by one of these individuals saying, I had my rights violated.
I think a lot of people and our listeners had a lot of questions about the jury selection process from episode 17, like Feline Byline from Reddit. We're on cats. said, it seems amazing to me that the prosecutor's prior jury foreman and a relative of someone associated with an alternate suspect ended up on the jury. How unusual is that?
Well, in a small town, it's probably not that unusual. Well, ending up in the jury, sorry. Up in the jury is unusual. It should definitely not happen. In terms of the jury pool, I would say not that uncommon. The whole pool here was 250 people big that they chose the jury from.
But this was another county. I mean, they moved it, correct?
They did, to Glynn County.
Yeah.
So that's why it's not even that far away.
Oh, it's not? Okay. Well, it still seems surprising to me that it was that limited that you're running into people with that kind of a connection.
Well, Glynn County is where Brunswick is, and Brunswick's the sort of bigger town in the area, city in the area. So if you are going to be a drug trafficker living in Waynesville, Georgia, which is Brantley County, you're probably going to have a lot of business in Brunswick. That's where most people are. So it's not surprisingly the connections in Brunswick. What is surprising is that no one seems to have made an attempt to remove anyone from the jury that may be connected to the case.
Yeah, and another question about the jury that we got from Rose Coppola is, I just got my call for jury duty. All of this talk about the foreman's misknowledge of evidence has got me wondering, what do you do if you're a juror who thinks that another juror doesn't understand the direction from the judge, or, God forbid, reasonable doubt?
You talk it out.
And you can go to the judge. So you can submit questions to the judge, ask for another explanation of what is meant by guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. You can ask for how to treat the evidence in the case. So they can go to the judge and ask questions.
That's right.
Judge might be responsive. They might pretty much say, go back and deliberate and not be too helpful.
The judge is going to be like, go F yourself. Sorry. They don't want to deal with that.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it that they don't want to? Why would they be so standoffish?
It would seem like the guidance would be. Like, you don't want to create some kind of reversible issue through doing it.
Ah.
Yeah.
Got
exactly.
It.
That's, there's sort of legion cases where judges try to explain guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and it almost always creates this appealable issue because the defense, after a conviction, says you misstated the law. And so the judge wants to keep their guidance to the jury to a minimum. Now, sometimes the judge will be very helpful and will give very clear instructions, but as Susan notes, many times they'll just sort of go back and deliberate.
They don't want to deal with it. If they think that not giving answers is not going to be reversible, they're probably not going to give an answer.
So I wanted to get back to Judge Williams. So she was sanctioned, or because she actually resigned before she was sanctioned. Is that correct?
She did. She resigned about a month after this happened. So the This American Life episode came out, I think, in March or spring of 2011. And then in November of 2011 is when the JQC filed its charges against her. And she was out by January.
And then you mentioned that the JQC got neutered in the election. Why would the electorate do that?
Probably because it was a ballot initiative and they didn't understand what they were voting for.
Well, the ballot initiative was to abolish the JQC?
Yeah. Well, the way it's phrased, it makes it sound like it's a good thing. And jurors, probably most of them, not jurors, sorry, voters, probably most of them didn't know the ins and outs of what the JQC was and why it matters. So yeah, like the way it's phrased makes it sound like it's a really good thing to do this.
Yes, that is one thing that in California, we have many, many ballot initiatives. We often have competing ballot initiatives on the same subject matter on the same ballot.
What if they all get voted for, though?
Well, that's the thing. Exactly. There are some that directly conflict with each other. There are some that are the wording is unclear or the differences between them are really arcane. And when you're faced with many of them, you don't have enough time to do research on all of them in any kind of really responsible way. You just have to hope that, like, the paper that you read regularly has an editorial board that's done, a responsible job of looking into it. It's interesting because, and we're going to get into this question a little bit later, but, there are times when democratic institutions don't actually function all that well.
This is a good example of it, yeah.
And this is a good example of it.
I was looking at the language on the ballot measure when they passed it, and it sounds pretty positive. It says it will require the General Assembly to create and provide by general law for the composition, manner of appointment, and governance of a new judicial qualifications commission, with such commission having the power to discipline, remove, and cause involuntary retirement of judges. So if you just saw that and hadn't really read up on it, it sounds like, oh, they're creating this new commission that's going to be helping to discipline judges. What they didn't realize was it was actually gutting much of the power of this JQC.
Again, as a casual listener, that didn't sound in any way like it meant what it meant. So it was saying it was taking away the power from the JQC and giving it to the legislature. Was that what they were doing?
Yeah. Well, basically now it's not independent.
Right.
Ah, okay. So that's the difference.
And of course, like one of the guys behind the bill was in the legislature, but he was actually a former judge who was removed by the JQC.
Huh. We also got an interesting question from Lance Lovett on this subject. In Cobb County, most judges run unopposed. How do citizens have recourse for the things mentioned about Judge Williams' actions? Which is a great question. If a judge is running unopposed.
Too bad, so sad.
Yeah, there's nothing you can do about it. And we have that a lot here in California. We have, you just check a bunch of judges that you like. By the way, there's almost no availability of information about their rulings or any real, I find myself just leaving those blank because I don't, and I'm a guy who's fairly up on the criminal justice system and I don't know anything about these people.
Yeah. It's a problem. I think judges, it goes back to whether we should have elections for judges at all. Yeah. And I think very much no.
What mechanism would you suggest for appointing judges? Just appointing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Fair enough. And then they would be removed by also the same thing, by the same people that appointed them?
Well, I think you'd all have less issues with this in the first place if you had appointed judges. But yeah, that JQC could still do what it does. Elections or no. Or did, I should say.
Okay. We got a couple of questions about that a lot of people, when Donna was referring to the Pepsi bottles versus the glasses, It seems that the foreman said to forget about the glasses because they're outside the box. But somehow, Donna felt that the Pepsi bottles that were never tested were in the box.
Well, it's hard to recreate. I'll caveat that. It's hard to recreate what the juries actually talk about in that room. We're, you know, many years on. This is trying to reconstruct it from memories of different jurors, not all who recall things the same way. So with the caveat, we don't know exactly what happened. What seems to have gone on is that the foreman was using his lessons from the Metters case that he'd previously been a foreman on and was instructing jurors not to look outside the record. But how they define the record is what seems to have been the issue. Now, the glasses evidence, remember, it did not come in a form that would be easy to remember or use because it was also a stipulation. Like the DNA evidence, it came in the form of a written sheet of paper that was presumably read off to them right before closing arguments at the end of the trial. So it could be they also didn't really recall it. All they remembered hearing maybe is like, oh, there's no glasses now, but we have a stipulation that maybe the jurors didn't quite understand what the point was or the purpose was. And that could explain why both the glasses and the DNA were left out.
And in what possible circumstance would the information about the fact that the prosecution felt that Donnie Barentine was actually a witness to the crime, how would that be introduced? Would that be read in the closing statement, or would that be read when Donnie Barentine was actually introduced as a witness?
So they actually had the immunity agreement itself was given to them.
Was actually handed to the jurors to read.
Well, it was used as evidence, so it's handed over as evidence that they can look at. So yeah, they would have had that for them to, you know, see. And I'm surprised more jurors didn't come to the same conclusion, because you see that immunity agreement and it makes perfect sense to assume that must be what happened here. Because why else would a prosecutor have written that?
Yeah, that would have been huge evidence in a jury room. If I was sitting in a jury room and it's here in black and white, we know Donnie Barentine was there, was a witness, that even though, by the way, his testimony, though, would have contradicted that, wouldn't it? Or was
not
his
that
testimony?
I recall. Ah. Not that I recall. Over
okay.
and over again.
Right. He was not denying anything. He was saying, I just don't recall.
So you've got a paper. You're sitting there with a paper of the prosecutor saying point blank, this guy got immunity because he was there. He was a witness. Well, that would completely explain why Donna created this whole, you know, why she felt that both of them were there at the time.
Yeah.
Oh, OK. I'm sure there are plenty of listeners who put this together as they listen to the podcast.
Or I didn't explain it right. But yeah, that's like when I first talked to Donna, I was like, what the heck is this lady talking about? And I knew she was not just like crazy coming from nowhere, because she was so detailed once she recalled to a pretty amazing degree. So I knew that she wasn't just like totally like some batshit theory she came up with. And I couldn't figure out where she got this idea until I realized, like, based on what she saw, it makes perfect sense.
So I wanted to get to episode 18, which was the prosecutor's immunity, which revealed some troubling patterns in John Johnson's previous prosecutions. I think one of the things that struck me as incredibly tragic was the Jimmy Metters case that you described. It jumped out at me as a listener of Undisclosed that it sounded like his legal redress that he approached was an ineffective assistance of counsel. Whereas, you know, we're all screaming Brady violation because that's what we do here at Undisclosed. do you have any insight into why they didn't pursue a Brady claim?
I think part of it is just because of how fractured the nature of the appeal was. After the trial, there was an appeal brought by the same attorney that had the original trial. And there was remand after they got the Supreme Court of Georgia because they basically were like, they should bring up an IAC issue. And you can't have the same attorney represent you in that. So they go back on remand to the trial court. And at that point, the original trial attorney is very sick, can't appear for evidence, and then dies before a decision is made. So I think part of the issue was like, one, the guy who brought the whole claim in the first place was the ineffective attorney. So there's, yeah.
Awkward.
Yeah. So they did bring up IAC in the end by bouncing it back to the trial court, but that was just for that issue, when in fact, the ineffective attorney was the one who made the appeal and decided what claims to bring, and also did not know at the time about the Highway 303 police reports. It was during the remand, the new trial attorney filed an open records request with the police and got these reports himself, and then discovers, oh wait, the prosecutor had them all along. So part of the issue was the fact that the attorney wasn't available because he couldn't testify and say, I never saw these. So they couldn't actually say for certain that the attorney had never found them because he was not there to testify. I think they got scared off because of that. And the prosecutor's story is that the defense did have them or had the chance to see them, but he couldn't really see. He was like, oh, during a 6-month period before trial, they came in and looked at all my files, so they must have seen it. Well, if they did, didn't you think it was odd that they didn't bring it up at trial when it was directly on point and would have massively helped the defense's case? So the prosecutor's story, John Johnson's story, is that he did make it available and the attorney just never talked about it, used it, or made a copy. But I'm very skeptical of that.
And Colin, so at this point, that ship has probably sailed in terms of any way to pursue this at this point?
Yeah, I mean, you can file what's known as a successor habeas petition, but that would require essentially new evidence that wasn't available at the time. And so, yeah, that claim is pretty much dead at this point.
And we got a question from Piccola1922, who says, is it possible to initiate a full-blown audit and investigation regarding all of the lost evidence from this jurisdiction? Who can initiate something like that?
No one is going to.
You need something like a consent decree with the Department of Justice, but they're unlikely to be interested in something like this. They're sort of a bigger fish to fry working with like Baltimore and big jurisdictions on these huge issues of corruption and policing.
Yeah, and we got another question. Is anybody working on trying to come up with systems to store evidence in a better way? Is that the thrust of anybody's work at this point?
I mean, that implies the problem here is the system.
Ah, which is always tough. But I sympathize with local jurisdictions. You know, the evidence often comes in many odd forms, like, a piece of rug in this particular case, you know, and just physically storing all that is difficult.
Well, it was stored just fine. The problem was that the prosecutor asked them to destroy it once he found out an appeal was happening.
Yeah, there's that.
Storage was not the issue in the circumstances.
Yeah, and how on earth he, you know, gets away with explaining it the way that he did, explaining it away, rather, is appalling. But in a larger sense, you know, we need to reform that. You know, we need to have some sort of rules for how things are stored, for, you know, requirements for how states create these facilities that do the storage. I feel like it's a huge area that nobody really seems to discuss.
Well, in this case, it's actually more feasible because the evidence that was lost, a lot of the evidence that was lost by the GBI, the state level organization, which would make it relatively very easy to actually try and do oversight there. You're not dealing with counties and local jurisdictions and home rule and all that stuff. But the GBI is the one who had the fingerprints in the Larry Lee case that went missing. And also, coincidentally, all the fingerprints and evidence like that in the Dennis Perry case that went missing. And they can't really explain how it went missing. It just is. Like, we've tried to find the GBI's file, and they're always like, oh, it's just gone. Sorry. And you know what? For a state-level agency, that's not okay. It's grossly incompetent, and they should be accountable to the legislature. But so far, no one seems to be paying attention to that over in Atlanta.
You know, they point out, and you guys did just a masterful job of pointing out, that in these small towns, the sheriffs are facing, you know, very low pay on the one side and almost no accountability or oversight. So, of course, these kind of things happen. But the GBI is funded. It's a state level agency. It's not a small town jurisdiction. It should be the thing that fixes some of the issues from these smaller towns.
And they often are. It's just in some cases, things like this happen. I mean, there are plenty of times where the GBI is considered the outside force that's trying to take on little corrupt, like, local agencies. And they do that. Like, that's who, when state-level action happens against these local jurisdictions for corruption, it's the GBI doing it. So they're not in the same team exactly, and there's definitely plenty of times where they have taken a stand against it. But then you have cases like this where you just magically lose the fingerprints in the one case the local jurisdiction wants you to lose. Like, it's just... it's not plausible. Like I said, they keep losing it when it's just these cases.
Yeah, you don't seem like you're prone to making statements like you did at the end of that one episode where you basically said, you know, clearly this is happening on purpose at this point.
I mean, if you can't prove it, generally if I can't prove something, I'm not going to say it. And at this point, it feels like a lie to be pretending I don't know damn well what happened. Because you look at take the Larry Lee case. You've got the records they had in that case showed that all the fingerprints for the other cases in 86, they're there. It's just mysteriously this one case that happens to have gone, like, walked off by itself. I don't think so. And in Dennis Perry's case, when you lose literally every single piece of evidence, again, that's a very hard jump to call that just another oopsie. We'll be right back.
With the holidays fast approaching, meal prep is the last thing you want in your plate. But what if cooking delicious, wholesome meals was easy? It can be with Blue Apron. Blue Apron takes the chore out of meal prep. Their website and mobile app make it easy to plan my meals each week, and I never have to worry about last-minute trips for forgotten ingredients. Each meal comes with easy-to-follow recipes and perfectly portioned ingredients. But don't just take my word for it. Last week, I gave the gift of Blue Apron to my mom for her 70th birthday. She got the steaks and brown butter sauce, the cheesy broccoli calzones, and Sichuan-style pork and noodles. My dad and she made the meals together, and they said they were easy to make and delicious to eat. And now you too can get or give the gift of Blue Apron. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free at blueapron.com/undisclosed. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
We got a question from Dickens Little, who at one point talks that they are a mental health professional who has all kinds of, there's all kinds of systems to check them if they do something inappropriate in their job. So they ask, what systems are in place for prosecuting attorneys and judges and police? Because they mess with people's lives, too. In other words, like a prosecutor like John Johnson, we've obviously had a lot of issues with prosecutors and possibly misusing their power. In Georgia, is he an elected official?
Well, the district attorney is. He would not be, but his boss would be.
And conceivably, the district attorney could be held responsible for a subordinate's actions, I would imagine.
Electorally, they could be.
Yes, exactly. So the idea would be that the public is the ultimate arbiter of whether or not they did something egregious.
But see, I don't think the DA here had a problem with it because in 2007, when John Johnson got the assistant DA award, the DA, Stephen Kelly, wrote the nomination on the basis of the Swain case saying, John Johnson had all these boxes of evidence. He spent months going through it. So you're saying John Johnson had all the boxes of evidence, that then maybe it's not just the sheriff's office we should be looking at for where it went missing.
Yeah, and I wanted to get to what is hinted at, obviously, by some of the evidence, that clearly John Johnson felt Donnie Barentine was involved in this crime. And yet found a way to give him immunity and let him go completely free from this, even though he brought the hammer down on Dennis Perry. I mean, can we figure out any kind of handle on what on earth Donnie Barentine could have been worth to the state to make a prosecutor just let him go from a crime like this?
An easy case against Dennis Perry. I don't think it takes more than that.
Really? I feel like it must be hinting at that he turned state's evidence on some much bigger case.
No, that's what the conclusion she came to, which is totally reasonable. But looking at Johnson's history, I mean, he has a pattern of this. He'll prosecute one, go for the death penalty, and the other likely accomplices end up walking away. For instance, in the Jenkins case, where the 17-year-old intellectually limited kid gets the death penalty, he was caught the day after the murder with three friends, and they were in the victim's van. And not all the friends were involved in the murder, but they all got immunity. And one of them says that it was Jenkins and his other friend who had the van together and that they, quote, did it. So there was a lot of evidence that whatever happened with Jenkins, his buddy that testified against him was there with him, along with his Woods guy. And the DA, Johnson was just fine with choosing one to prosecute and then the rest go away. And there's a lot of reasons for that, because it makes it, if your goal is to get a conviction, just one conviction, call a case solved and be done with it, it is the best strategy.
Yeah, you find some culpability in someone that you can definitely prove, and you use the sort of cloud of other people against that person.
You take away the confusion and uncertainty, because if you don't have them testifying, then it's harder to convict, because they can wonder, maybe other ones did it. But you give them immunity, they appear on the stand, they convince the jury that this is not a complicated case. And they'll accept the simple narrative that the prosecutor is putting forward in order to get his easy, solve the case conviction.
But it seems so arbitrary with Dennis Perry, since there was just no evidence, concretely leading him there. I mean, obviously, Dale Bundy was the link at that point.
Leading him where?
Leading him to Dennis Perry. My point being, there was no physical evidence. There was nothing. It was just the work of Dale Bundy that brought Dennis into any kind of possible culpability for this.
But there's eyewitnesses and there's his confession.
You're right.
Yeah. If he believes that, and I guess maybe he did, then If he also thinks it's like, well, obviously Barentine did it. Simple answer here is that Barentine and Dennis Perry did it together. That's how we can all be right.
And I wanted to get to episode 19, Paper Town Gothic, which got into how the Gilman Paper Company's presence had sort of warped the politics of this small town. And it had direct links to the Swain case as well, which, you know, I think blew a lot of people's minds. Was this knowledge that you guys had when you started this run of episodes, or is this something that you guys have sort of stumbled across?
Oh, I did not know I started the case. I was just researching. I can't remember what. And probably just like looking for more cases in Camden just to get background on stuff. And I'm looking at this crazy case about the Gilman paper factory. And it talks about a very like large 270-pound black male named Lawrence Brown, who was the hitman in the case, or possible hitman in the case. And I'm like, that can't be. I mean, there's got to be two Lawrence Browns by that description in Camden County. And I keep looking into it, and it's definitely the same guy.
That, because that just blew my mind. Although, and a few things came to mind. I thought, you know, wow, $1,500 for a hit.
I know.
That's reasonable.
Even back in the, like, that feels like cheap to me, even back in the 70s.
You're literally getting bang for your buck. I'm sorry. That's awful. These are human lives are at stake. I apologize for that. And again, it takes another twist when Lawrence Brown's stepdaughter was the one who somehow got the insurance policies. His stepdaughter?
Well, it was, yeah, it's his stepdaughter. And that's one thing I've still not been able to figure out is how much money he got. Lawrence Brown believed his stepdaughter was going to get $100,000. I do not know if the policies were actually $100,000. Far as I can tell, based on limited information, I think they're probably, you know, maybe a third of that. But still, it's clear from the record that leading up to that, he firmly believed that, like, it was $100,000 and he was, quote, going to make sure LaFane got it.
Yeah, again, it's mind-blowing. And with a murder, obviously, you know, insurance is going to pay off as long as there's no connection. But I feel like insurance companies will find a connection if they possibly can. And I feel like, wow, they dropped the ball in this area because they're always looking for that. Wait, you know, we don't actually have to pay this out.
Okay, so this is the total conspiracy theory. I'm only mentioning because you brought it up.
Okay, thanks. It's my fault.
Do you remember a few episodes, like, I think episode like 6 or 7, we talked about the white nationalist who was also a suspect, who confessed on the phone, mm-hmm. and had his wife, ex-wife at the time, said that he had the three-piece glasses.
Okay, yes.
His dad gave that policy.
Oh, you're kidding me.
I know. It's like, okay. I'm like, if you want a reason why an insurance company wouldn't look too deep at a story, but that's getting out there. I'm not promoting that as a possible explanation for what happened, but I've definitely run through that possibility.
Okay. Mind blown once again. I'm glad you didn't put that in the show because I couldn't have handled it. I honestly could not have handled that. But one thing I was really grateful that you did put in the show was, you know, a lot of the context on, you know, how a company town works in that period. You know, company towns are a fairly new, in terms of, you know, historically, it's fairly late stage capitalism that has brought the company town, the corporation that basically starts or completely takes over one town. And an interesting aspect of that is it warping how a sheriff works in that situation.
How everything works, yeah. I mean, they become, it's impossible to separate the government from the company because the people are the government. The people are also part of the company. So for a lot of reasons, it's just not feasible to actually have an independent government at that point.
And you have sheriffs who have to be politicians to begin with mm-hmm. because it's an elected office. In this case, again, I lauded the fact that you actually got an interview with Bill Smith, but we got a lot of pushback because his quote was, you know, again, somewhat, only somewhat mind-blowing that in that he had trained at the FBI and been a Marine in the service. You know, obviously on the surface, that would make him for an excellent candidate to be sheriff, along with his obviously family connections. But when to sort of wax rhapsodic about J. Edgar Hoover— it threw me off a little. We got a listener named Eric Chung who said, also, what the hell did Bill Smith mean about the way the FBI is now? Is it the fact that they're investigating our president or the president is attacking it? It was unclear where he stood on that.
Yeah, he was opposed to what Comey was doing to break the law to investigate people.
Ah, yeah.
He was definitely, that was where he was going with that.
But Comey isn't the director of the FBI anymore.
He was. And he was saying about what Comey's investigation did. The context was where he was talking about the bad things the FBI did today and how when he was in the FBI, they never would have done the kind of bad things that Comey and his people are doing now.
Okay.
He also wanted to make sure I knew that J. Edgar Hoover was not gay, just so for the record.
Oh, great. Okay.
just so you know.
Terrific. you know, again, that is neither here nor there. I mean, obviously, people had much bigger issues with J. Edgar Hoover,
yeah.
You know, the COINTELPRO program. And at one point, he was suggesting we get rid of habeas corpus. Why not? let's give it a try, J. Edgar.
Yeah.
He was a man of his time. And there are obviously great things about the FBI, but their history is problematic,
to say the least.
In many respects. But then again, so is Bill Smith's. So it's kind of perfect.
If you see what Hoover did as like a model of law enforcement, I mean, that explains a lot of decisions that may have been made at Camden County.
Yeah, because he was in many ways a political operative. You know, he was in many ways trying to enforce patriotism. For all intents and purposes. You know, these are things that a law enforcement officer isn't actually supposed to do, you know, and he was keeping secret files on political figures and, obviously breaking the law in many respects when he felt that he was investigating people who were subverting the goals of America. So it was a view of law enforcement as a tool, as opposed to what many people believe law enforcement is supposed to be, I guess.
I know a lot of our listeners began listening to Undisclosed because they got pulled in with the Adnan Syed case. Well, here's the thing. We wouldn't have started Undisclosed if it wasn't for the fact that Susan, I, and Colin were all blogging on websites. That is the power of having a website, whether it is advocacy, because that's what I used it for, whether it is, you know, showcasing your work, whether it's to sell products, things that you create, services that you can provide to others. It really can make all the difference. If I did not have a website, I could have posted as many times as I wanted on other social media about Adnan's case. It wouldn't have made a difference. So Undisclosed started with prolific blogging on websites that Susan, I, and Colin used to get our voices out. So what about you? Can you use a website to get your voice out? Probably. And to make that easier, you have Squarespace. I love Squarespace because they have beautiful templates that are created by world-class designers. I'm not tech savvy and I'm not a very creative person. I can't make pretty things, but I don't need to, because in Squarespace, I can just click and design it so easily. It's so intuitive. They also have powerful e-commerce functionality. So if you create things in your own home, it lets it sell you online really easily. You can customize the look and feel, the settings, the products. Everything is just click, point and click, point and click. Everything's optimized for mobile right out of the box. You don't have to create a different version of your website for folks' cell phones. Your website will appear beautifully on people's mobile phones. They've got built-in search engine optimization, free and secure hosting, nothing to patch or upgrade ever, and 24/7 award-winning customer support. I mean, it can't get easier. So look, if you're ready to start your own business, if you're ready to have a voice, if you want to showcase what you already do, it's time to get your own website. You can think it, if you can dream it, you can make it with Squarespace. And right now, if you go to squarespace.com/undisclosed, you get a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, just use the offer code undisclosed and you're gonna save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Once again, go to squarespace.com/undisclosed. You get a free trial, you get to create your website, see what it's gonna look like. And when you're ready to launch it, when you're ready to go live, use our offer code undisclosed and you're gonna get 10% off your first purchase of that website or a domain name. Remember, a dream is just a great idea that doesn't have a website yet. Make it a reality with Squarespace.
And we got a listener question from More Sunny Days, who says, Susan drew me a map, but the connections between the hitman situation in the 70s and the Swain case in the 80s have to be explored further. And we got to layer in who benefits from protecting the players in both. Does Bill Smith have a reason to protect L. Brown?
Well, hopefully it was clear in the episode. The sheriff involved in this whole thing was Willie Smith. That was his father. So not Bill.
Ah, that is a good point.
It's Willie.
Because it is hard to tell the players without a scorecard. I mean, again, this is also one of the detriments of having a familial dynasty.
Yeah. Smith,
you get
Smith.
Them confused on your podcast.
This was Willie Smith, who was working with the D.A. Glenn Thomas during these interviews. And it's still extremely unclear what was going on. And there aren't really any heroes in the story. From all the evidence I've seen, I tend to believe that it's some version of a Gilman offering Lawrence Brown to do bad things. But really, I don't know if we can... I mean, Lawrence Brown is playing both ends against the middle. It's really hard to tell who was what. And Carl Drury, obviously, he did go to prison in 2001, I think, for trying to hire a hitman to kill his wife. So it's, you know, if you're trying to figure out who hired who, that could be a point in favor of he was the one who hired Lawrence Brown to pretend to be a hitman.
So, yeah, there's ways you can go either way. I mean, these are all very complicated characters.
Yeah.
Roscoe Dean, another complicated character.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say first with Dr. Carl Drury, the whole – so what the woman who – the girl who was the alleged victim in the rape did recant. But there is evidence in the record that the pieces I can find now that suggests the story might have been more complicated and that although the story about the rape seems to have been fabricated, it's possible he was having – illicit relationships with underage girls that were his patients, because the stuff I've seen does not support the story about the hospital rape. That does not seem to happen at all. But there were some concerning bits of evidence that made me wonder if there's more to the story than simply a straight up frame job.
Well, we actually, More Sunny Days had many questions that I can pepper you with. Also asked, is there a confirmed case in the 80s where Larry Brown was going to be a federal witness? He was a witness in the Gilman Drury hitman case in 1976. It doesn't line up with the Swains murder in 85.
Oh, yeah. That part's totally disconnected.
Okay.
We'll have to get more into Lawrence Brown's legal troubles later.
Well, she had more questions. She says, then there is the drug angle. Are the Wilkes family mafia and the Dixie mafia connected, or are they two separate mafias?
They're the same. Well, Dixie mafia is a thing. It's a real thing. But a lot of people like to call themselves Dixie mafia. So it's hard to call like what's a real Dixie mafia. And I'm sure there were different groups that were like both wanting the title of real Dixie mafia. I'm calling it the Wilkes County Mafia because that's the one that specifies which group of Dixie Mafia we're talking about here. But yeah, they're all Dixie Mafia.
Got it. Also, this is an organization that is loose at best. they didn't take roll call, although the closest, obviously, to that would be the contact list that Donnie Barentine turned over.
That was just his personal phone contacts, though. That was not actually a Dixie Mafia contact list. That was his own like supplier network, dog network. Chicken fighting network.
Yeah. So, and that's, by the way, a whole other area. So there is dog and chicken fighting. This is not dogs fighting chickens.
No.
This is dogs fighting dogs and chickens fighting chickens. By the way, I'm from New York. I don't know these things. We don't traffic in these things in New York. Well, actually, we do. Actually, I do believe there was cockfighting in New York for a while. Neither here nor there. So these would all be sort of money-making enterprises that people would pay to attend these events?
Well, some of it was just like, you know, I talked to people on the list I could find, and a couple of them were, you know, I fully believe them. They were just straight up, they were involved in the chicken fighting. They knew Barentine socially from that, and that's all it was. They weren't involved in the drug trade at all. So it's not fair to say that everyone on that list was a drug conspirator, but a lot of them were, probably most of them.
Yeah. And also, like criminal organizations everywhere, they just make money off of whatever is illegal that the public wants.
Yeah, but this is also probably like I'd call this more of a passion of Greg Barentine's.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did he train dogs and chickens?
Oh, yeah.
For this?
Yeah, he did. In his obituary, his family has a line that says, Greg Barentine loved dogs and chickens. I'm like, well, that's one word for it.
That's, yeah, you have a weird way of showing it.
Yeah.
Gosh. Okay. Yet another layer of Donnie that we're getting every week.
That's Greg for the record, I should say.
Oh, that's Greg Barentine. Mm-hmm. Ah, okay. I got confused. Oh, God. Again, this thing has grown to such an extent that it is sprawling at this point. It's a novelistic span of characters. We got a thought from J.D. Cooper, who says, something to look into. I'm sure the county is exempt due to being a public entity, but there's a lot there that could point to the general shadiness of the act of polygraphing an employee for non-employee-related issues. There may be more case law on that exact matter. And this is, of course, referring to the Mike Ellerson case where Mike Ellerson, by the way, seems like a fascinating person. To have been on law enforcement during this period sounds really, really interesting. Did you learn much about Mike?
It was fascinating talking to him. He had so many great stories, and he was up there in the middle of it. And he's such a, as you can probably tell, like, very straightforward kind of guy. He just talked about his, like, he started off playing football in college. And if he told me if he could do it all over again, he stayed in college, stayed playing football instead of going to law enforcement. But he had a family, young family. So he left college, got a job, and that's how he ended up in law enforcement. And he's straight up will say, like, it's the worst thing I ever did. Bad choice for him. But you can tell he's conflicted because he obviously had good times there, too. And that the deputies all, like, had each other's backs. They, you know, it meant a lot to him. But at the same time, like you said, he's surprised more people didn't get a heart attack from it because it was so stressful and so political and constantly all the bogus stuff you can imagine went on in Bill Smith's sheriff department. But the polygraph was top of the list because that is some I couldn't even understand what I was hearing when he told me the story. Straight up polygraphing employees to find out if they're talking bad about you.
Yeah, exactly. It's one thing if he's, you know, suborning perjury or, you know, doing something that is legally actionable, but just talking shit about the boss?
Yeah.
That's polygraph worthy?
It's the biggest case in the Camden County that year, apparently.
Correct me if I'm wrong. You at one point mentioned that he was brought in to talk to Venzola Williams and Cora Fisher.
Yes.
Is he African American?
He is.
Got it. Did you think that played into it?
Oh, that's 100%. That's why they brought him in. Is because he knew them. He knew their families. He knew their kids and their grandkids. He was straight up brought in because these women were not going to talk to Dale Bundy, and they needed someone who could actually, you know, explain to them what the deal was and who they'd actually trust. And that was Ellerson.
And I imagine African-American officers in this particular organization have a very particular experience.
You know, yes and no. It was not as I talked to him about that. And like, I mean, there were some issues, but I would not say that racial harassment was, well, we'll get more in that next episode. But it wasn't the first complaint he had by a long shot. And that, I mean, it was a fair, not, I wouldn't call it integrated, but yeah, it was sort of integrated. It was not an all white force by any means. When Sheriff Smith got elected in 84, the chief deputy was a black man. And he resigned when Sheriff Smith came in because he couldn't deal with him. But it wasn't like an all white force we're talking about.
Yeah. And it was mentioned that many of the police officers knew many of the people at Rising Daughter. So they weren't a community that, you know, were completely segregated.
Oh, it wasn't very like segregated. That. Deeply segregated.
Oh, okay. I was hopeful. My hope, Susan.
It was extremely, it wasn't extremely segregated, but there were real relationships across racial lines. So it was segregated and like how you'd expect in a small South town. But that doesn't mean that there weren't actual connections between people in different parts of the county.
So these episodes listed all kinds of crazy sort of small town law enforcement boondoggles, you know, prison escapes and inmate labor and drunken joyrides and squad cars. But obviously this all comes back to the sheriff. And if the sheriff is a political figure, are they actually going to be held accountable in these situations? So have there been any ideas sort of proffered to depoliticize the sheriff's office in these small towns?
You know, I'm not even sure I'd say that the politicization is the main problem. It's a driver of it. I don't know, given the role of sheriff. I mean, the problem is just a structural issue of how the sheriff operates, how little oversight they have, what kind of power they have. It's just, frankly, not a very democratic institution. I think you'd need a much more structural overhaul to make it more manageable. Or you have places like, say, Floyd County. The reason you never heard about the sheriff in Floyd County is the sheriff's jurisdiction was limited to the jail. He was not actually involved in law enforcement.
Oh, that's interesting. So who was the law enforcement there?
That was the police.
Oh, okay. But the sheriff doesn't have jurisdiction over the police?
No, they're separate entities.
Huh.
The sheriff's traditional role is as jailer. That's usually the foremost, like that's what the sheriff, if you got to define one job, that's it. But in many counties, they also serve as the law enforcement arm. And the sheriffs are still law enforcement at the jail. It's just they don't have general jurisdiction to like investigate crimes or do like patrols.
Got it. Okay. We got one last question from Connie MCGI, who says, is there any way to get a complete transcript of the trial?
Yes, we're working on it. We have for many months. Surprisingly, they're not being very fast about it.
Speed has not been their watchword so far.
I am hopeful that one day we'll have a copy. But yeah, if you're interested in learning more about the South and the sheriffs there and how this whole system operated, you should definitely check out the book Praying for Sheetrock. It's a, like we said in the show, McIntosh County, not Camden. And the dynamics there were different for a lot of reasons. But to get an idea of like the power the sheriffs had and how that played out in real life, it's a great read.
Well, thank you, Susan. And thank you, Colin. These episodes have been fantastic. And it was a blizzard of them. I was so excited about it. My dog walks were just spectacular because of it. So thank you, guys. And I believe we've got one more addendum that won't be for a couple of weeks. Is that correct?
Next Monday will be the penultimate episode in the series. So we have two more full episodes to go.
Oh, okay. Got it. Well, yes, I'm not available for the next addendum, but I will be for the one after that. And thank you guys so much. And I will see you in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, John.
All right. Thanks, John.
And that's it for the addendum. I want to remind everybody that Undisclosed has a Patreon, and you can get bonus episodes there with Susan, Rabia, and Colin. Much enjoyment. It is patreon.com/undisclosedpod. We would love it if you could help the show. If you have any information regarding Dennis Perry's case, call us at 410-205-5563 or email us at undisclosedpod@gmail.com. If you feel like checking out our website, it is undisclosed-podcast.com. There's a list of all the criminal justice-related charities that you can make a donation to. I am donating all of my fees for this season to the Georgia Innocence Project once again. You can find them on the web at georgiainnocenceproject.org. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle at undisclosedpod and send any questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. I'm going to thank my assistant, Andrew Congdon, once again, very, very helpful, as well as Hannah McCarthy, who chops all this up and edits it back together in beautiful form for our audio production. Patrick Cortez does our haunting, haunting addenda theme, and Methil Telhan is our project manager. Thank you all, and thank you so much for listening, and I can't wait for the next couple episodes.